This is the last day of this September-October 2013 seven-day session. And the koan that we'll be looking at today is the last one in the Blue Cliff Record, number 100, Haryo and a Blown Hair Against a Sword. This is a short one. A monk asked Haryo, "What is the sword against which a hair is blown?" Haryo said, "Each branch of coral reflects the bright moon." Haryo is his Japanese name, and his Chinese name is Ba Ling. Reading here from Andy Ferguson's book, Zen's Chinese Heritage, we have just not much about this really outstanding master. He was a disciple of Yunmen, Ummon, great Tang Dynasty master. We don't have any dates for Ba Ling, but Yunmen's are maybe the 9th century, something like that. At their first meeting, Yunmen asked Ba Ling, and now he's quoting another master, "Open the gate and Bodhidharma comes." And then Yunmen said, "I ask you, what does this mean?" Ba Ling said, "Blocking the master's nostrils." This presumably is a reference to killing. Yunmen said, "The spirit king of the earth unleashes his evil. A demon leaps from Mount Sumeru up to Brahma heaven and pinches the nostrils of the heavenly emperor. Why have you concealed your body in Japan?" Ba Ling said, "Better that the master not deceive people." Yunmen said, "Pinching this old monk's nostrils, how will you do it?" Ba Ling was silent. Yunmen said, "Now I know you're just studying the flow of words." You know, some of these dialogues that I read from in Taisho, but dialogues between the old masters, are opaque because of the cultural references that we don't know. I don't know either. So some of them are clear enough to people who've worked on a lot of koans. Others, not so much. When Ba Ling took up residence as a teacher, he did not create a document of succession for his students. He only used three turning phrases as the way to attain the essence of the Yunmen school. And these are the three. A monk asked, "What is Tao? What is the way?" Ba Ling said, "A clear-sighted person falls in a well." The version that we use for that is an enlightened person falls in a well. That's the first of these three koans. Second is, a monk asked, "What is the blown feather sword?" That's today's koan, of course. Ba Ling said, "Coral branches reflect the moon." And then the third one, a monk asked, "What is the teaching of Kanadeva?" He's one of our names in our ancestral line, Zen master. "What is the teaching of Kanadeva?" Ba Ling said, "Snow in a silver bowl." Yunmen said, "In the future, on my remembrance day, just restate these three turning phrases, then you will have repaid my benevolence. So he's very strongly approving of his Dharma heirs' three phrases. Later, when Yunmen's memorial occurred, it was in accordance with his instructions. There are a few others, but I'm going to just read one more. When Ba Ling was leaving the mountain, he gave his whisk to a monk. This is the horsehair whisk that the Chan masters would use, that have at hand. We're told that it was to whisk away flies, mosquitoes. It became an emblem of authority of a Zen teacher. He gave his whisk to a monk. The monk said, "Originally, there is only purity. Of what use is a whisk?" Ba Ling said, "Once you have known purity, nothing can be forgotten." Originally, there is only purity. Awakening reveals that there is only this original nature. There is only this Buddha mind. Contrary to all reason and common sense, as evidenced by the way people in the world treat one another, the way we treat one another, still, there is only this enlightened Buddha mind. How can that be? How can we make a statement like that? Each branch of coral reflects the bright moon. That's all the biographical material that I have. Back to the koan. A monk asked, well, let's use his Chinese name. It's not as hard as many of them. Ba Ling. A monk asked Ba Ling, "What is the sword against which a hair is blown?" This reference is to supposedly the sharpest of all swords is one that could cut a single hair blown toward the blade, and not just cut it crosswise, but to split it. So this mythical sword that can cut even a hair blown against it. Of course, one thinks of the sword of Manjushri. Manjushri is the bodhisattva of wisdom, always shown either sitting astride a lion or wielding a sword, or sometimes both, symbolizing the sword of wisdom, the delusion-cutting sword of wisdom. For for Sashin, we have our own figure of Manjusri enshrined on the altar, sitting astride the lion, representing the tremendous effort to wield this delusion-cutting sword of our own nature for these 7 days. What is this sword that can cut anything? The blade is so sharp, it's immeasurably sharp. It's so sharp, it's not there. This mind of wisdom that we all share, that we all have in equal measure, it's the mind of emptiness. Zen Master Basui urged his monks to cut, 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 cut. Anything that comes into the mind. Cut. And everyone near and here knows how to cut. Whenever we swing our attention from the thought forms or other stuff of the mind and bring it to the particular form of our practice, the breath, the koan, the inquiry, or the formlessness that is shikantaza. Every time we do that, we are wielding the sword. We are fighting our deep-seated tendency to pursue thoughts. We're fighting our deep-seated tendency to either suppress feelings and emotions or to cling to them. This cutting is not suppressing. That's a question that comes up every once in a while. People say, well, when I have some feeling come up or emotion and I just return the mind to mu, to the breath, aren't I suppressing the feeling or emotion? No, what you're doing is cutting the thoughts that bind you to the feeling or emotion. Zen has no quarrel with feelings or emotions. It's, how could we? It's part of being human. It's our nature as human beings to have feelings. To have feelings arise, last a shorter or longer period of time, and then move on through, just the same as thoughts do. So we don't have a quarrel with feelings or emotions any more than we have a quarrel with thoughts. But should we dwell in thoughts about the feeling, the emotion, or those who are associated with a feeling or emotion, who provoke the feeling or emotion? And of course, also if our thoughts about ourselves, then we bind ourselves to the feeling or emotion. We don't want to do that. We want to get out of the way. Cutting is a way to get out of the way and allow the natural passage of things that arise in the mind. Desires, passions, cravings, cut, cut, cut. Not suppress. That would be a losing battle. We don't want to fight the cravings, but nor do we want to yield to them. And when we return our attention to this, just this moment, here, now, in the form of breath or koan, then we are refraining from getting sucked into the craving. And in doing this, by cutting through the thoughts that bind us to the cravings, the desires, the feelings, whatever, we come to see that desires, cravings pass. If we gave way to desires every time they arose in the mind, we wouldn't see that they all pass. As nearly as I can tell, this cutting, it's not actually cutting, it's just a vivid expression for what we're doing in Zazen. It's not that we're doing anything other than returning the mind to the practice or to the present. But this, let's call it returning then, swinging the attention back to this. This, I think, is what distinguishes Zen meditation from Vipassana meditation. In Vipassana meditation, as I understand it, having heard this from a very prominent Vipassana teacher in this country, it's when the thought arises, let's say, you don't just swing the attention back to the practice, your practice. You observe, you watch the thought, and then wait for it to recede, to fade or disappear. Which no doubt works. It's a great tradition, hundreds of years old, Vipassana Buddhist meditation. It seems that some of us have are more inclined to do it the Zen way of wielding that sword. So the sword is, you could say, our mind of attention. It is in our nature. We all have attention that we can use or misuse. And when we use this sword of attention to dwell in that which is beyond thought, again, the breath, the koan, then this is the way out of bondage to freedom. Now, what's intriguing about this koan is the difference between the response and the question. So again, the question is, what is the sword against which a hair is? Well, what's that sword? And the answer, each branch of coral reflects the bright moon. Sharp, then round and open. Koans usually in their formulation are contradictory. There's some element of contradiction, and that's the contradiction in this one. He's asking about a sword, and his answer is in terms of coral and the moon. The moon is one of the favorite images in Zen literature and art. Represents our true mind, our true nature, our essential mind. The circle is the only symbol in Zen. Zen does not use symbols. Or at least it's just about the only one. The only one that comes to mind is the circle. Because a circle, as people know who are wearing a raksu with a ring, a circle is about as close as we can come to representing perfection in form. Representing emptiness in form. Yeah. A circle is a circle. It's perfect. It's elegant in its simplicity. You can't have more of a circle or less of a circle. I mean, a circle is a circle, maybe larger or smaller. Has no beginning or end. It's not only in Zen where you see the significance of the circle. I have a passage here from Black Elk, the Native American sage, who said, "You have noticed that everything an Indian does is a circle, and that is because the power of the world always works in circles, and everything tries to be round. The sky is round, and I have heard that the earth is round like a ball, and so are all the stars. The wind in its greatest power whirls. Birds make their nests in circles, for theirs is the same religion as ours. The sun comes forth and goes down again in a circle. The moon does the same, and both are round. Even the seasons form a great circle in their changing and always come back to where they were. The life of a human is a circle from childhood to childhood, and so it is in everything where power moves." In Zen, the circle, the calligraphic circle, is called an enso. We have this magnificent, huge enso at the end of the hall here outside the zendo. And even closer to the zendo, we have these doors that lead into the courtyard with the enso carved in it. Each branch of coral reflects this bright moon. There is a lot in this koan that resonates with another major school of Buddhism called Huayan Buddhism, or Kagon. Huayan is the Chinese name. Kagon is the Japanese. And there's a lot of overlap between Huayan Buddhism and Zen Buddhism. I'll be reading here just a couple sentences from the Encyclopedia of Eastern Philosophy and Religion. This school teaches the equality of all things and the dependence of all things on one another. Its teaching is known as the teaching of totality, since according to the Huayan view, all things participate in a unity, and this unity divides itself into the many, so that the manifold is unified in this one. The great classic symbol of this interdependence of all things, and all things reflecting the one and the one in all things, is the it's called the Indra's net. It's a reference to an Indian god, but Indra's net is this fantastic web, infinitely large, infinitely complex, this web of threads, golden threads, and in every intersection where two cross, there is a jewel. And so there are countless millions, billions of intersections, countless jewels, each one reflecting all the others, all reflecting one, one in all. Each branch of coral reflects the bright moon. Every single phenomena is the manifestation of mind, this true nature, mu. Every tree, every leaf on every tree, every vein in every leaf of every tree, every blade of grass, every insect, every drop of water in the oceans, each koan is reflecting this bright moon. Every koan in its own unique way is a reflection of this essential nature. The Buddha holding up a flower. Tozan, when asked about Buddha nature, said 3 pounds of flax. 3 pounds of flax. Not a bunch of flax, but 3 pounds. There's a poem by Galway Kinnell called Saint Francis and the Sow, female pig. Saint Francis and the Sow. The bud stands for all things, even for those things that don't flower. For everything flowers from within, of self-blessing. Though sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, to put a hand on its brow of the flower and retell it in words and in touch, it is lovely, until it flowers again from within of self-blessing. As Saint Francis put his hand on the creased forehead of the sow and told her in words and in touch blessings of earth on the sow, and the sow began remembering all down her thick length from the earthen snout all the way through the fodder and slops to the spiritual curl of the tail, from the hard spininess spiked out from the spine down through the great broken heart to the sheer blue milken dreaminess spurting and shuddering from the 14 teats into the 14 mouths sucking and blowing beneath them, the long perfect loveliness of a sow. One of the joys of Sesshin comes afterward when we meet others and see in every face things that we don't usually see. Not that we can put in words what we see in each face, but each face is telling a story, and it is magnificent. It is beautiful in its own way. In the Kensho account in The Three Pillars of Zen, the Canadian housewife talks about, after her Kensho, of seeing even in the scowl of a face, seeing this exquisite Buddha nature. It is beyond good and bad, right and wrong, happy and sad, this or that. We were walking through the village in Tepetzlan one day. This is when I was living down there with Roshi Kaplo, helping him on one or another of his books. And he loved, at the end of the day, to take a walk through this in many places, this is quite a primitive village. They say that many of the residents still speak the native Aztec language, Nahuatl, and a lot of the roads are just dusty and dirty, and I mean just dust. They're cobblestone roads, but then there are also just dusty roads. And we were walking there once and came upon there were animals all over, horses and chickens and pigs and of course dogs, and we came upon a pig with its snout in a pile of wet shit. And it was just in heaven. And Roshi stopped and leaned on his, he always used a walking stick. He leaned on his, with his both hands on top of his walking stick. And he looked at this pig there, oblivious to us, of course, just in heaven. And with his face just radiant, he looked at this and he said, pigs are such gross creatures, such beautiful creatures. Each branch of coral reflects the bright moon. There's a verse in the Book of Koans called the Denko Roku, the transmission of a lamp. Goes like this: the silent mind ringing in 10,000 ways, Sanganandi, Gayashata, as well as the wind and chimes. There's a wonderful story in this collection I often read from called Stories of the Spirit, Stories of the Heart, Parables of the Spiritual Path from Around the World, edited by Christina Feldman and Jack Kornfield. And it's about a monastery that had fallen upon hard times. I'll begin by reading it. It had once been a great order, monastic order, but as a result of waves of anti-monastic persecution in the 17th and 18th centuries and the rise of secularism in the 19th, all its branch houses were lost and it had become decimated to the extent that there were only 5 monks left in the decaying mother house, the abbot and 4 others, all over 70 in age. Clearly, it was a dying order. And then I won't read it verbatim, but there was in the deep woods outside the monastery, there was a little hut where there was a rabbi from a nearby town. He'd use it as a hermitage sometimes. They had great respect for this rabbi, and they whispered to one another, these 5 monks, maybe the rabbi would have some advice. So he welcomed them welcomed the abbot to his hut. And the abbot told this story of woe, of decline, and the rabbi was sympathetic. He commiserated. He said, no one comes to the synagogue anymore. And when the abbot was about to leave, they embraced. And the abbot said, any final word of advice you can give me that would help me save my dying order? And the rabbi said, no, I'm sorry. I have no advice. But the one thing I can tell you is that the Messiah is one of you. Well, the abbot returned to the monastery and his fellow monks gathered around. Well, what did the rabbi say? And the rabbi said he couldn't help. We just wept together. The only thing he did say, though, just as I was leaving, I don't quite get it, was that the Messiah is one of us. I don't know what he meant. And now I'll read from the text. In the days and weeks and months that followed, the old monks pondered this and wondered whether there was any possible significance to the rabbi's words. The Messiah is one of us? Could he possibly have meant one of us monks here at the monastery? If that's the case, which one? Do you suppose he meant the abbot? Yes, if he meant anyone, he probably meant Father Abbot. He had been our leader for more than a generation. On the other hand, he might have meant Brother Thomas. certainly Brother Thomas is a holy man. Everyone knows that Thomas is a man of light. Certainly he could not have meant Brother Elred. Elred gets crotchety at times. But come to think of it, even though he is a thorn in people's sides, when you look back on it, Elred is virtually always right. Often very right. Maybe the rabbi did mean Brother Elred. But surely not Brother Philip. Philip is so passive, a real nobody. But then, almost mysteriously, he has a gift for somehow always being there when you need him. He just magically appears by your side. Maybe Philip is the Messiah. Of course, the rabbi didn't mean me. He couldn't possibly have meant me. I'm just an ordinary person. Yet, supposing he did. Suppose I am the Messiah. Oh God, not me. I couldn't be that much for you, could I? The U is the capital Y, so I guess it's talking to God. I couldn't be that much for you, could I? So as they thought about this, the old monks began to treat each other with extraordinary respect on the off chance that one among them might be the Messiah. And on the off chance that each monk himself might be the Messiah, they began to treat themselves with extraordinary respect. Because the forest in which it was situated was beautiful, it so happened that people still occasionally came to visit the monastery, to picnic on its tiny lawn, to wander along some of its paths, even now and then to go into the dilapidated chapel to meditate. As they did so, without even being conscious of it, they sensed this aura of extraordinary respect that now began to surround the five old monks and seemed to radiate out from them and permeate the atmosphere of the place. There was something strangely attractive, even compelling about it. Hardly knowing why, they began to come back to the monastery more frequently to picnic, to play, to pray. They began to bring their friends to show them this special place, and their friends brought their friends. Then it happened that some of the younger men who came to visit the monastery started to talk more and more with the old monks. After a while, one asked if he could join them, then another, and another. And so within a few years, the monastery had once again become a thriving order. Period. Each branch of coral reflects the bright moon. Let's name these branches. More of them. John, Keith, Kathleen, Alex, Arthur, Susan, Dan, Cecily, Paul, Danae, Darren, Addison, Scott, Stephen, Catherine, Ed, Catherine, David, Bowden, I guess, Josh, Errol, Wayman, Hean, Joe, Bill, Andy, Karen, Hayes, John, Jason, Francesco, Sudama, Terry, Ingvar, Jeanette, Chris, John, Jim, Cynthia, David, Flora, Loretta, Grant, Ben, Jeff, Truman, Jim, Janet, Devin, Mion, Scott, Phil. All the moon of Mu. Mind. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.